Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Okay, continuing. Tasmad siddhe siddhayam shaktau drishte tishrotri pratiti virodha bhave vaktus tatpartyam api tatra satyatiti siddhavan nirdishtanam upanishad adinam api swarte pramanyam astyeva taduktam tasman mantrartha vada yur anya paratve pi sorry, I just lost the place. Anya paratve pi swarte pramanyam bhavatyeva tadyadi swarasata eva nishpratibandham avadarita rupam anadigata vishayam chavigyanam utpadyate shabdat tadantarenapi tatpartyam tasya pramanyam kim nasyat. Let's see what we have now. Now that it is thus established that statements of fact have denotive power, and that a hearer whose perception of a statement is not obstructed can be seen to realize the meanings of the speaker intended, the meaning the speaker intended, it follows that texts like the Upanishads, which speak of matters of fact, are authoritative in their literal sense. Again, a reminder, this class starts at 10 o'clock. Try to be here on time. Statement is a fact have denotive power. Okay. And somebody... If his power of hearing and thinking is in working order, he should be able to figure out what the statement means and what the speaker intended by it. So, texts, the Upanishads, which speak of statements of fact about the absolute truth, they're authoritative in their direct sense. You don't have to screw out a figurative meaning. What they say literally can be understood as description of the absolute truth. Whew, boy. Okay, continuing. This has been said as follows. Now, it's said in a book called Bhagavan Nama Komedi. Who's the author in Bhagavan Nama Komedi? Is written by Lakshmi Dara. Do you know anything about the book? He's quoted by our acharyas. It's an early book. Who is Lakshmi Dara? Anyway, it's a book that describes Krishna's names. It analyzes them. And that's quoted here, long quote from the Bhagavan Nama Komedi. Even when mantras and their explanations are subsidiary to other statements, their own literal sense is still authoritative. That means, okay, even if you say that the injunctions are primary and the statements of fact, the descriptions of fact, have only a secondary purpose, still what they say is authoritative, and they can be understood directly without interpretation. So, if from Shabda a specific understanding arises that is not contradicted in its literal sense, that is comprehensible. Okay, now sometimes something that the Shastra says may apparently contradict something else that you accept as fact, another statement of Shastra or your own personal experience. Then you have to reconcile. Something has to be modified to make the two apparently contradictory ideas fit, both be true. But if there's no contradiction in just taking the literal sense, then you have a simple understanding just from hearing the Shastra. And that refers to something heretofore unknown. Okay, now another reason why Shastra will fail to have significance if it tells you something you already know. There's no need to hear what you already know. So the pramana is significant when it when it gives you information you don't have already. Logic is important. Other pramanas are important in ascertaining things you don't already know, that you have a doubt about or just lack of information. The Shastra may tell you that that fire melts ice, but you don't need to hear that from the Vedas. You already know it. Okay. Okay, so if all this is true, from the sound, you get a specific understanding, and not a vague, but a very, very specific, concrete understanding. It's not contradicted, even if you take it very literally. If that's the case, and you can understand what it means, and it's telling you something you don't know already, then why is that shabda not authoritative? Even if it does not express the intention of any author. Okay, why not say it's authoritative? Why not accept the shabda as pramana? Even if it doesn't have an author. Because if it doesn't have an author, then how can it have a tatparya? How can it have an intention of an author if there's no author? But even if that's so, it's authoritative anyway, even if it doesn't have an author. When the statements of Scripture offer praise and criticism, when they repeat something already known from another source, when they explain the qualities of things, and when, moreover, the Upanishads, independent of any other authority, make known the truth of the self, truth devoid of everything undesirable, consistently endowed with unlimited bliss, and not already known. Okay, that's what's special about the Absolute Truth. It's devoid of everything undesirable. It's all auspicious. It's full of bliss. And you don't know it already. Then, even when other means of knowing are contradictory, it is the other means that are reduced to a shadow of themselves, leaving the Scripture authoritative in its literal sense. That's Bhagavad Mama Komedi, and he's more or less answering the Mimamsakas, who say that those sentences in the Vedas which just praise or criticize something, like, you know, someone who performs the Agni Shtoma sacrifice, you know, is will have all his desires fulfilled, he'll get chariots and children and lots of wealth. That's a praise of the sacrifice. Or someone who doesn't observe a codicil will go to hell for 10,000 years. That's a criticism. Now, these are just artivadas. Praise and criticism, and also repeating something already known from another source. That's anuvad. Just, you know, you already know from your experience that fire melts ice. But the Vedas tell you that anyway. That's just repeating something you already know from another source. That's another kind of artivad, or just embellishment. Or, as far as the Mimamsakas are concerned, when the Upanishads talk about the Absolute Truth, that's also artivad. Because it's a statement of fact, it doesn't tell you to do anything. Therefore, all of those artivads are not of much significance, according to Mimamsakas. But Lakshmidhar is answering, then that shabda is perfectly authoritative, even if you have some other pramana that seems to contradict your shabda, the other pramana is wrong or has to be modified. It becomes just a shadow of itself. The shabda is always primary authority. Okay, any questions about that? Just understanding that. Not general questions, but understand. Do you understand what that means? Yes.
This sentence. So, if from shabda a specific understanding arises that is not contradicted in its literary sense, that is comprehensible and that refers to something, therefore, heretofore unknown, why is that shabda not authoritative, even if it does not
express the intention of any author?
So this I don't understand. Even if it does not express
some people say, how can the Vedas be authoritative? They don't have any tatparya. They have no intention of an author because they have no author. So without lacking a tatparya, it's less significant. This is not Mimamsaka. I don't know who says this. Somebody else says that. That the Vedas are not so great. They're not so invaluable as a pramana because they don't have any author. And therefore there's no intention of the author. So nothing's intended. What's the significance? Just words. They may mean something, but there's no intention behind it. No purpose. Because there's no author to have a purpose. Of course, it's actually the intelligence of the Supreme Lord. So there is a purpose. It's just nobody wrote it. So it's a rhetorical question. Why is that shabda not authoritative? That's a roundabout way of saying definitely it is authoritative. Even if it doesn't have an author, even if it doesn't have an apparent, obvious intention of an author, it's complete authority. Does that make sense? You guess. No, it doesn't. Yes, okay. Okay, any other confusion about what that paragraph means? Any part of it? And then we read the commentary. Anyway, this is the quotation from Lakshmidhar, from the Bhagavan Nam Komini. See, it's important for us to establish the authority of the Vedas. The Bhagavatam is authoritative based on the authority of the Vedas. The Bhagavatam explains the Vedas, but the Vedas are the first authority. And we dealt with the Mimamsakas and the Prabhakaras because they were saying some strange things about the authority of the Vedas, like only part of them are authoritative. We're insisting that all of the Vedas, all the statements in the Vedas, are completely authoritative. That was what that whole digression was about, to show, to prove that every statement in the Vedas is perfect authority. Okay, and then the commentary? Like Jaimini's Mimamsakas, the followers of Vyasadeva's Vedanta philosophy accept the primal authority of the Vedas. Okay? That's what we share with the Mimamsa school. They believe in the primal authority of the Vedas. Other schools may give lip service to the Vedas, but they don't really pay attention to them. But the Mimamsa school and the Vedanta school take the Vedas to be all important as authority. We'll go there before we go to any other authority. Whereas the Nyaya school, they'll go to logic first and hardly really have anything to do with the Vedas. They just acknowledge them, but don't even really pay attention to them. But we take the Vedas and the Vedic supplements to be the primary authority. Now, these are called sister schools. When you have these six traditional orthodox darshanas, they're actually three pairs of sisters. They're allied schools in pairs. The Vedanta and the Mimamsa are a pair of schools. They both share some of the same basic assumptions. But Mimamsa is dealing with ritualistic understanding, and Vedanta is dealing with transcendental understanding. The Nyaya and Vaisheshika schools are closely allied. Nyaya deals with questions of knowing, epistemology, pramana, pramana shastra. But what are the things that you can know? What are the things to know? That's ontology or prameya shastra. That's dealt with in the Vaisheshika philosophy. And they both share, they don't disagree with each other very much at all. In fact, in later centuries, the two schools, Nyaya and Vaisheshika, merged into one school, Nyaya Vaisheshika. And then Yoga and Sankhya are allied sister schools. Because Sankhya presents a certain theory about the nature of reality, and Yoga accepts that theory and then gives you the practice for self-realization. So Sankhya and Yoga go together. Mimamsa and Vedanta. Actually, one other terminology is there's a Purva Mimamsa and Uttara Mimamsa. The first Mimamsa and the second Mimamsa. That's Jaimini school and Vyasadeva school. Okay, continuing in the commentary. But Vyasadeva's followers go beyond the Mimamsaka's ritualistic interpretation. The Mimamsakas deprecate as not... What does deprecate mean? To do what? Decrease? Decrease in importance? Well, let's see. Let me check the dictionary. Well, to say that something's not very important. To criticize something is not important. That's to deprecate. The Mimamsakas deprecate as not very significant those statements of the Vedas that are mere explanations and value judgments. What the Mimamsakas call artavada. And the attempts of the Upanishads to define an absolute truth. They also deprecate those as not very significant. For Vedantists, however, the purpose of the Vedas is not only to enjoin, but also, that means to make injunctions, to tell people to do things, but also to reveal facts unknown by other means. In the view of the Vedantists, discovering the higher truth that unifies all existence is even more important than learning how to act dutifully. Thus, the first sutra of Jaimini's Mimamsa Sutras, Atato Dharma Gigasa, now let us inquire into duty, is superseded by the first sutra of Vyasadeva's Vedanta Sutras, Atato Brahma Gigasa, now let us inquire into the absolute truth. Atato Dharma Gigasa, what's the second sutra of Jaimini? No, it's Dharmo Chodana Lakshana. What Dharma is the injunctions of the Vedas. Chodana is pushing or enjoining. So it's characterized as the pushing or the injunction, and it means injunction of the Vedas, not your mother-in-law nagging you, not that Chodana, but the Vedas nagging you. That is what Dharma is. Just like Brahma is defined in the second sutra of the Brahma Sutras, Dharma is defined in the second sutra of the Mimamsa Sutras. According to Jaimini, the Vedas include five... Here's an explanation of what this Artavad business is. According to Jaimini, the Vedas include five kinds of texts. Mantra, injunction, definition, prohibition, and explanation. Those are the five different kinds of sentences. Mantra is the first, just like the mantras of the Rig Veda. Then the injunctions, that's second. Definitions and prohibitions and explanations, those five categories. in his view, Jaimini's view, an explanation, Artavad, though of no importance on its own, can supplement either an injunction or a prohibition. Prohibition is just a negative injunction. And it can be of three kinds. Three kinds of Artavad. And then there's a Karika. I don't think we can identify who wrote it. It's a very old, proverb, whatever. Virode gunavadaksyad anuvado vidadate butartavadas tadanad artavadas tridamataha. Three kinds of artavad, and they're called gunavada, anuvada, and butartavada. Translation of the verse: when something is apparently contradictory and therefore in need of being clarified, there is description of a quality, gunavad. When something is known, something known from another source is being recognized, there is restatement, anuvad. And when neither is the case, there is simple statement of fact, bhuta artavada. Those are the three kinds of artavad. For example, here's examples of all three. When a doubt arises about whether the post on which the animal is sacrificed can be the same as the sun in the sky, maybe you've got, it's a wooden post. You actually strangle. You don't cut his throat. You strangle the animal. No blood should be shed. You just suffocate him. But you tie him to the post and then suffocate him. And then you may say, well, this post, somebody told me the post is equivalent to the sun. I heard that somewhere, but I'm not sure about it. Then the Gunavada confirms. Aditya Upaha. The sacrificial post is the sun. Okay, the Vedas tell us. In other words, it has the quality of representing the sun. So that's a description of a quality of the sacrificial pillar, that it's equivalent to the sun. Although a thing is already known from sense perception, an anuvad reiterates. For example, Agnir Himasya Beshajam. Fire contradicts ice. Fire counteracts ice. That's an anuvad, because you already know that from experience. But the Vedas are repeating it. That's a anuvad. And third kind, as a simple statement of fact, there is bhutardavad. For example, Indra Vitraya Vadram Udayachad. Indra raised the thunderbolt against Vitra. That's just an historical account of what Indra did. That's just a statement of fact. No particular quality is being said and no repetition. So it's neither the other two. So it's a simple statement of fact, bhuta artavad. Again, Jaimini says that these three different kinds of artavad are of little meaning on their own, but merely contribute support to injunctions to perform prescribed duties. Some argue that Vedic statements lack tatparya, the intention of a speaker, because the Vedas have no author. But even if this might be so, the author of the Bhagavan Nama Komedi assures us the Vedas are capable, with or without the intention of any speaker, and in spite of any contrary evidence from perception or logic, of describing the reality of the absolute truth. Okay, so the Vedas do their job. And ultimately, the purpose of the Vedas is to reveal the absolute truth. Brahman. Okay. Any comments on that? Yes.
What kind of a book is this Bhagavan Nama Kaubadi?
I don't know it very well. We have a copy of it. Has anybody read it?
And this author...
I've seen quotations from it. We have it upstairs, but I have never read it.
This Lakshmi Dara, he's a Mimamsaka or a Vedanta?
No, he's a Vaishnava. I'm not even sure what Sampradaya. Maybe Madhva Sampradaya. But it's before Lord Chaitanya. Yes.
In In other words, the Mimamsakas, they kind of indirectly say that the Vedas cannot describe the absolute truth, according to what's concluded here.
Well, we'll see. But there are descriptions of the absolute truth in the Upanishads. They don't deny that. They say that it's of no importance. It serves no real purpose that the Vedas describe an absolute truth. They see no value in that. It's just, mythology. Just stories. Say so. Of course, it's a nice idea, as Madan Mohan suggested yesterday, the injunction is, when you're being told a statement of fact, the injunction is, accept it, believe it. So there is an absolute truth. Believe the absolute truth. Worship the absolute truth. That's the actual injunction. That's there, but they're just so attached exclusively to their rituals, to their performance of sacrifice, that they don't care. What to speak of the Supreme Lord, they don't care even for the demigods. Jaimini says something like, the demigods may exist or not, it doesn't matter. What matters is that we're told about demigods in order to encourage us to do the sacrifices. And whether they really exist or not doesn't matter. And the Upanishads tell us about an absolute truth. He doesn't say this, but he's implying the absolute truth may be described in the Upanishads, but whether that absolute truth is real or just a fiction, it doesn't matter. The only value of those descriptions is to encourage us to do our sacrifices. The absolute truth exists, therefore do your duty. Just like Santa Claus is there, and if you're not good, he won't bring you any presents. Yes.
They should have some prayojana fixed in their mind to do the sacrifices. I mean, they must be having some prayojana fixed in their mind to do these sacrifices.
Yeah, they're very attached to it.
But for what reason they are doing this? To be
greed. They want to attain heaven.
But if they don't believe in demigods and they don't care for the existence of such things, then how they want to go to heavenly planets and enjoy there?
They want to enjoy soma juice and the apsaras, that's all. They don't care about Indra, they care about the soma and the apsaras. They're materialists. Materialists will go to church and pray very nicely and put money on the plate, but they really don't care about God. They just care about making a show of being a good man.
Hare Krishna. What is meant by the statement that texts like the Upanishads, which speak of matters of fact, are authoritative in the literal sense? So in other words,
Maybe we don't have to say texts like the Upanishads. We just mean the Upanishads are authoritative.
Yeah, so in other words, they say that they're...
The Upanishads are similar texts.
They're authoritative, but not in their literal sense.
We're saying they're authoritative in their literal sense.
But they say that they're authoritative in their non-literal sense or figurative sense.
They're not really authoritative, but they lend support to the injunctions which are authoritative. And if there's any significance to the Upanishads, it's a secondary thing. Like, literally it says, Narayan is the Supreme Lord, in the beginning there was nothing but Narayan. Well, that means nothing to the ritualists, but they can, from that, get an implication. Therefore you should do yajna. And it's like an implied meaning. It's not the literal meaning of the statement. The Narayana Upanishad doesn't tell you to do yajnas, but the Mimamsaka will, that's what they'll see the significance of the Upanishad.
Just I just trying to understand what Jiva Goswami concludes, because this paragraph all follows the previous he's mentioning of the arguments.
Where exactly is the line of thought? What are the words?
No, just this paragraph we're reading today is basically the conclusion of the
paragraph we finished
yesterday. So basically what's the thought line where's the thread which leads from yesterday's paragraph
to the
today?
Upanishads are authoritative. And you don't have to interpret them. You just take them on face value. What the words say is authoritative. You don't have to twist some secondary meaning out of them. The obvious literal meaning of the Upanishads is authoritative. That's basically it. You know, you read Nostradamus and there's some cryptic statement which really means that New York will be, will fall into the ocean in the year 2020, supposedly. And he says, the dragon will swallow the sun or something. So the literal meaning is the dragon will swallow the sun, and the implied meaning is New York is going to fall into the ocean. So you have to interpret Nostradamus to get the real meaning. But you don't have to do that with the Vedas, with the Upanishads. Upanishads tell you Narayan is the absolute truth, that's it, that's what it means. You don't have to squeeze some other meaning out of it. That's all. And then then the rest of it's all the quote from Bhagavad Nama Komedi.
This definition of Arthavad was given in
of Arthavad.
No, five types of Arthavad.
Three kinds of Arthavad. Five kinds of statements and three kinds. And Arthavad is one of the kinds, and then there's three sub-kinds of Arthavad.
Okay, so in those five types, the last one and the next sentence starts as the explanation in brackets Arthavad.
So explanation is the fifth kind, and that is Arthavad.
That means the other four are not exactly Arthavad?
No. That means Arthavad is only the fifth category.
But the statements, definitions, these don't fit into the category of injunctions also. They are just
right. Injunction is only one of the five categories, although prohibition is just also injunction, but negative injunction. So you could say prohibition is also a kind of injunction.
But
the mantras are the actual worship, the actual prayers offered to different deities. That's another kind of statement.
But there are no injunctions in the mantras.
Well, mantras are significant because you have to use the mantras. Sacrifices are made out of mantras. There's a mantra and the dravya. You make physical offerings, but you have to chant the mantras also. You need the mantras, otherwise you can't do a yajna. The two ingredients of a yajna are the mantras and the dravya. So you need, and the devatas, third. So without all three, and so you need mantras as a necessary component of yajna. That's the significance of mantras. It doesn't matter what they mean. In fact, most of the times we can't figure out what they mean. They're not written in human language. Human beings can't understand them. But you need to chant them. You can't do a sacrifice without chanting the mantras.
That means
they come first.
They extensively use the Samhita portions and the Brahmanas portions, because the Samhitas give the mantras and Brahmanas explain about
Brahmanas give the injunctions and explanations and definitions. You find all the other, the last four. And the injunctions, definitions, and explanations are found in the Brahmanas.
But the Aranyakas give even more.
They just give more esoteric of the same.
So they don't consider.
And Upanishads also give the same, but even on a spiritual level.
So they focus only on the Samhitas and Brahmanas. They give less importance to Aranyakas and no importance at all to Upanishads. Is it so?
Less importance. They wouldn't say no importance. There's some connection with the actual injunctions. Therefore, it's important. Otherwise, the Vedas wouldn't include it if it had no connection. So there's some, but it's a very indirect, very distant connection. So it's of very little importance. Say the Upanishads. Upanishads are way out there in left field, but there's some connection. You can trace out in Upanishads allusions to and ideas that are based on the system of yajna, the performance of sacrifices. You can see how out of the ideas of sacrifice, out of the whole system and all the ideas it involves, a lot of the contents of the Upanishads is connected with that. Okay. Should we move on?
Yes.
Okay. Let's see what's said next. Tadevam sarvasmin api vedatmake shabde swartam prati pramanyam upalabde sakatam artam prasuta iti vivriyate. Now that we understand that all the verbal expression that constitutes the Vedas is authoritative in its literal meaning, we already said that, right? That's nothing new. Now, having accomplished that, we must explain how it generates that meaning. How do the Vedas produce their meaning? The actual mechanism. Okay, so let's see what comes up now. How do the Vedas let us know what they mean? Tatra, Varnanam, what are Vedas made out of? Yeah, out of phonemes, letters. Words are made out of letters. The letters are the aksharas. You can't split up the aksharas. They're the atoms. You can't split it any further. The smallest piece of language is the akshara, indivisible phoneme. Tatra varnanam ashu vinashitvan nartam janayatum shaktik sambhavati. Tatascha purva purvakshara janya samskaravad antyakshara syaiv arta pratyayakatvam manyante. Okay, here's a theory. We should consider first that because individual sounds quickly ceased to exist, they lacked a force to generate a statement's meaning. Why do individual sounds quickly cease to exist? What does that mean? What disappears? The sounds. The physical sound disappears. That's a statement, that's just a fact of science. Light is a little more persistent. I can shine a light, a flashlight, a torch, and that light can keep on going to the other end of the universe for millions of years, actually. But sound dissipates pretty quickly. If I'm talking here, maybe someone can hear a little bit of it outside. 3 blocks away, they don't hear any of it. It's gone. By the time the sound reaches 3 blocks away, it's dissipated, it's gone. So sound disappears very quickly. In fact, the statement here is, I'm saying words one after another. In the words, there are phonemes, aksharas one after another. Each akshara is perceived for a very short time. Otherwise, I would be hearing all the aksharas at once. It would just be, like if 10 people start speaking at once, saying 10 different things, you can't understand anything, right? So if I have in my sentence 20 words and 5 aksharas on the average in each word, that's 100 aksharas in one sentence. If I could hear all of them at once, it would just be cacophony, like 10 people all speaking at the same time. I wouldn't understand anything. So what actually happens, you just hear one akshara, it persists only for a short time and disappears, and then you hear the next one. They can't be overlapping too much, because otherwise they'd be on top of each other and you wouldn't understand anything. That makes sense? So the aksharas persist for a very short time, and they're followed one by another. Well, that creates a problem. If they quickly cease to exist, they lack the force to generate a statement's meaning. Because by the time you get to the end of the sentence of 100 aksharas, all the aksharas are gone. They're not there anymore. How are they going to come together to make the meaning when they've disappeared? Okay, here's your grand theory.
So So in other words, it's not the aksharas that makes us understand the statement. It's not the aksharas that makes us understand the statement.
Well, we'll get to that. There's a couple of different theories about that. Some people say, no, it is the aksharas. And some people say, no, it's not the aksharas. Two different ways of approaching it. Okay? Like, who's your great-grandfather? Maybe you know who he is, but you have a great-grandfather. Every one of us has a great-grandfather, right? Even if we don't know who it is. And anybody have a great-grandfather who's still alive? They're all dead. But they're still a great-grandfather, even though they're dead. So a thing that's gone can still have some effect somehow. So therefore, there's two different ways of approaching this. That the aksharas are making the meaning, or the aksharas, something else is making the meaning. But we have a problem here. The aksharas are disappeared. How are they going to make the meaning? Okay, but keep it relevant. Yes. That's not relevant. Okay, let's hold on to that. Because first we have to see what the theories are. Before we present our own theory, let's see what theories there have been. You sure it's not relevant? All right, go ahead, say it.
The aksharas do not have the meaning, but they create or evoke meaning in us because we're the conscious observers or listeners, and they just evoke the meaning which stays in us, and then they can just retire later on. It's not a problem.
Okay, that's an explanation. Let's see how. What we have recorded here as the traditional explanations. Okay. The individual sounds quickly cease to exist, therefore they lack the force to generate a statement's meaning. Therefore, the opinion of some scholars is that the last sound linked to the mental impressions created by each sound before produces the recognition of the meaning. Okay, the last sound. Okay, maybe you still remember the last sound, even though the other ones you forgot. But the other ones left some impression in your mind, some residue in your mind. So the remembrance of the last sound connected with the residue, the impression left by the other sounds, that produces the meaning, recognition of the meaning. The meaning is there in the sentence. What we have to produce is recognition of it in your head. You have to understand the meaning. The meaning is there, but the problem is, how do we understand the meaning? Okay, this is one theory. The opinion of some scholars is that the last sound linked to the mental impressions created by each sound before produces recognition of the meaning. These mental impressions are known only from their effect, since they are not accessible to sensory perception. That means they're unconscious. You've got impressions left by the sounds you don't remember anymore. All those little phonemes in the sentence. You don't remember them, actually. If you did, your mind would be all jumbled with 100 different phonemes. But what you have is some unconscious impressions left behind by them. You only know them from their effect. You don't know them directly because they're unconscious. What's the effect? The effect is the meaning of the sentence in your mind. Okay, that's one theory. But then some other theory, there's others who have a different theory. Samskara, okay. Samskara karyasya smaranasya kramavartitvat samudaya pratyaya abhavan nancha varnyasyapi varnasyapi arta pratyaya katvam ityabhi pretya apare tu spotameva tat pratyayakam ahu. Okay, so there's another group of philosophers who object to this theory. Why? Other scholars think that because of the sequential nature of the remembrance produced by mental impressions. A whole statement is not simultaneously perceived. You have an impression left behind by each phoneme, but even you remember those impressions one after another, not all at the same time. So you still have just 100 different ideas. And so not even the final sound can make the meaning known. Okay, you hear each sound, 100 sounds, and you hear the last sound. When you get to the end, you say, okay, this is the last sound, let's put it all together. But all you got in your mind is impressions left by 100 different sounds, one after another. It still doesn't come together to make one whole. So these philosophers who object on this ground, that there's still nothing to make a single meaning come out, they propose that what makes us known is spota, a special kind of special potency. This is the spotavad, created by Bhartrahari. He started a whole school of philosophy called the spotavad. They're also called the grammatical monists, because they take the theory of grammar and extend it to a sophisticated theory of semantics, of how things are known. And they say that you have to introduce this idea of spota. The real meaning of a sentence is not all the little meanings of the letters or even of the words. There's a separate power there called spota. And every sentence has its own spota. What does spota mean? What does it literally mean, spota? Sput. Not Sputnik, but Sput. What does the word mean? Manifest. No. Sput does mean manifest. But a spota is a noun. It means explosion. You know, if you blow up a balloon until it pops, that's spota. Explosion. Burst. Okay, burst. So it's like you hear a sentence, and all of a sudden, boom, the idea blows up, you know, pops up in your head. That's the spota. These philosophers are Advaitavadis, in essence. But they have a special Advaitavad theory that the absolute truth is the sound of the Vedas. That everything evolves from sound. And sound is actually non-differentiated, just like the absolute truth, one without any parts, without a second. So the spota, or the transcendental sound, the real sound of the Vedas, has no parts. When we divide it up into sentences, and the sentences up into words, and the words up into phonemes, into aksharas, that's a fiction. It's illusion. There are no words, there are no phonemes. Just like there are no jivas and no God in the classical Advaitavad. In this Shabda Advaitavad, the Vedas are the absolute truth and they don't really have any divisions, not even sentences and words and aksharas. It's just a fiction, but it's a useful fiction. The spota is the reality. The real meaning of a sentence is the spota. Spota, okay, special kind of potency. And now we have a quotation. This is from Ashi Shankaracharya is summarizing. It's not his theory, but he's summarizing the Spotavad theory. I guess Spotavad is earlier, the original Spotavad is even earlier than Shankaracharya. Because he's paraphrasing it. In his Shriyakabhasha, he says, Satcha varna nam aneka twain aika pratyaya anupapater ekaika varna pratyayahita samskara bije antyavarna pratyaya janita paripake pratyayani Eka pratyaya vishayataya jyotiti pratyavabhasate. Okay, this is what Shankara says as the paraphrase of the Spotavad. And since the individual sounds, being many, cannot be perceived altogether, the seeds of impressions are planted in the person by the perception of each sound, one after another, and with the last sound, his awareness matures, suddenly bestowing the recognition that the statement is the object of a single perception. So he hears all the sounds, and then the spota goes off. The spota explodes and reveals the meaning. There's a potency in the sentence. After you hear all the sounds of the sentence, the spota is revealed to you, reveals itself to you. Okay. Let me read two paragraph commentary, and then we'll see if we have any time to ask any questions. Traditional Sanskrit scholars have been investigating the nature of their language for at least 2,000 years. And they have proposed various theories to explain how sounds, words, and sentences express meaning. These studies began with the theory of Sanskrit grammar, especially as formulated by Panini. Panini explained the entire language in both its Vedic and epic dialects in a precise, complex system of a few thousand sutras. He assumed, however, that sentences are nothing more than combinations of words, just as words are conventional combinations of sounds. And thus he focused his analysis on how individual words are formed. Right? You've been studying a version of Panini sutras, and most of it is talking about words, right? How words are formed. The grammar of words. He doesn't talk much about sentences. In the Karaka Prakaranam, he talks somewhat about something about sentences. But the focus is on the words. Panini is assuming the words make up the language, and the meaning can be derived from the words. Okay, well, that creates a problem. The difficult question of just how the words combine their meanings to yield the complete idea of sentences was addressed only by later thinkers. Panini didn't bother about that. But other thinkers started to worry about it. How do words combine to make the meaning of the sentence? Notably, the philosophical grammarians of the school founded by Bhartrahari in the 5th century. So that makes him two centuries before Shankaracharya. Bhartrahari criticized as naive the notion that one grasps the meaning of a word simply by recognizing one after another the phonemes that compose it, and that one grasps the meaning of a sentence simply by adding up the meanings of the words. So first of all, you put the aksharas together to make a word. And the naive theory is that you just take the meanings of the aksharas and add them together and get the meaning of the word. And then you take the words and put them together, hear them one after another, and put together a sentence. So there's two levels. Meaning of words on the basis of the aksharas, and then meanings of the sentence on the basis of all the words. So he proposed instead that a word possesses a special potency, shabda spota, that expresses the word's meaning, a potency not found in the individual phonemes of the word. It's something separate. It's not any power or shakti of the phonemes of the aksharas. It's something that belongs to the word as a whole, the meaning of the word. And then he similarly posited that another potency in a sentence, vakya spota, expresses the meaning of the sentence separate from the meanings of its individual words. Okay. Then there's a whole school that evolves, later generations of scholars who wrote books in the school of Bhartrahari. It went on for a few hundred years. Or 1,000 years even. They were writing books in the school. We have several of them in our library if you really, really wanted to look at them. They're there. Okay.
So if he says that the words and the sentences themselves have spota, or the potency to induce...
Not the sentence is a spota, sentence has a spota. The spota, which reveals the meaning, yeah. is a quality, energy of the word, of the sentence, yeah. or of the word.
So if that is so, then anybody who reads the words and sentences should be induced with this potency or spota.
If you know the language. If you know the language. If you don't know the language, it's just meaningless sound.
But even if a person knows the language...
Like to know the language means to know the spotas. To recognize, to be able to tune in on the spotas and understand them, that's what it means to know a language.
Like even so, this can also be extrapolated to the other languages like English and other languages.
The theory should be applicable to other languages.
So we clearly see that even if a person knows English, it is not necessary that he will understand the meaning of the sentence or the meaning of the words.
Well,
so if the potency of the words and sentences themselves are enough to implant the meaning, then everybody should
understand. How can I know English? The potency of the words, yeah, but knowing the language means being able to recognize the potency. Potency is there, but it does. The purpose of the potency is to create a recognition in the hearer. One who can't recognize it, he doesn't know the language. I can hear, you can speak some other language, and I can hear the words, I can even write them down, I can transcribe it, but I don't have any idea what it means. I hear all the sounds, if I'm listening carefully, but I don't know what they mean. That means I don't recognize the spotas. If I recognize the spotas, then I can say I know the language. This is spota theory. We don't believe it anyway, but according to them.
But even if you know the language, the system, the philosophical system might be entirely different apart from the language aspect.
Oh, so that's another problem. That's
so how can...
That's not understanding the tatparya. It's getting complicated. You may know the language basically, but you don't know how these philosophers use the words with special meanings. When you create a system of artificial thought, you know, which is on top of the normal language, you assign special meanings to the word. You give technical meanings to the words. If you don't know the technical meanings, and you don't know the formulas of the philosophical system, then you won't know what the philosophical statements mean.
So
that just means there's like a expansion of the language into a special jargon of philosophers. And if you don't know the jargon, then you can't understand what they say. But it's still the same principle.
So this process of recognizing the meanings is there inside the conscious living entity and not the unconscious word or sentence. Otherwise,
the theory is, the Spotavad theory is that the potency of recognition exists in the statement and in the word. And it creates a reaction in the hearer. So the potency is coming from the words, from the language itself, but a person who knows the language reacts to it by understanding. But the origin or the residence of the potency is in the language itself. That's their theory. It's not a quality of your mind, it's a quality of the words, the spota. And it does something to your mind. Just like the sunlight. The heat and light of the sun is in the sun, but it creates an effect in you. You know, you get a sunburn, or your eyes are dazzled, or you're very happy to see the sun. These are effects that are created by the sun, but the potency is in the sun itself, and then it has an effect on you. Okay, Madan Mohandro? Spotas are what?
Spotas in the word and not the mind.
Yeah.
Thank you.
At least that's their theory. That's how they present it.
How do they explain, people can make special abbreviations of words and they'll still have the same meaning? Or else sometimes people may even communicate a lot of meaning by silence.
Sorry, what was the last thing?
They may communicate a lot of meaning by silence. People may not just respond to a statement by silence. The silence communicates a lot of meaning to them and there is no spota. Looks like attached to that silence. How do they explain that? First abbreviation.
Well, I don't know if they, I don't know if anybody asked them this question. I'll have to be the devil's advocate and speak for them, because We understand that there's different, that language is not the only symbol system. That you can, without language, you can express some kinds of meanings. Like if I, go like this, that means, I'm going to hit you. I'm not doing it yet, but I'm intending to hit you. That's a symbol. The symbol of get out of my way. It's not language. And animals have such symbols. The monkey shows its teeth to tell you, I'm threatening you. I can bite you. So it's not using language. It's using gestures. That's also a primitive kind of symbol system. Language is just the special kind of sophisticated symbol system that only human beings and higher creatures have. Animals don't have. So you can resort to simpler symbol systems to get things known beside by language, yes.
But if their argument is that the meaning can only be created by spota and nothing else, then they should explain how this...
Well, they're saying, they didn't say that when a monkey shows his teeth, that you're not going to know what he means until the spota wakes. They apply this to language. You can't understand language without spota. Okay? Gestures. He doesn't say that gestures have to be understood by spota.
Well, if gestures can be understood without spota, then language can also be understood without spota, looks like.
No,
if
but there's... general epistemology recognizes more than one pramana. Shabda is one pramana. Pratyaksha is another. Pratyaksha has its own dynamics. It doesn't require a spota.
It appears that spota is a redundant theory in their explanation of meanings. If it's
Jiva Goswami is going to say that. Give him a few paragraphs.
Oh,
he is going to say that. He's going to dismiss it. He'll dismiss it. But first of all, let them have their say. Let them have their say. Come forward to their best theory, and then knock them down. So they're not done yet. There are another two paragraphs, and then Jiva Goswami will dismiss them. Yes.
Sometimes we express the meaning, as you told, gestures. So if I'm saying nasty, we are expressing the meaning using the facial expressions. For example, I'm saying nasty. At the same time, I say nasty. It expresses a different thing. So is it like a 50-50, like chance of expression on the face and the, like the spot you've been talking about?
Yes. The way that that's analyzed by authorities on poetry is that words have more than one meaning. And the gesture or the tone of voice helps you determine which meaning is intended or modifies the meaning. But that's a case of language that's modified by gesture. Language helped by gesture. It's still basically a linguistic phenomenon. You say a word, but you say it with a certain tone.
Especially the, questions or exclamatory or something like that.
Yeah. That's part of language. Language includes its own kinds of gestures.
Oh, thanks.
Okay. One last comment. I'm running out of energy. Yeah.
I'll give an example of this. According to language, I hope I won't offend any devotee, but sometimes Indians, they go like this.
Yeah.
And Westerners, at first, we don't understand what it means. But after a while, you start to understand the language.
What does it mean?
I still don't know.
It means maybe yes, maybe no, but I'm not telling you.
Do they have this Shabda Dvaita Vada? Do they have a Vedanta commentary for in their line?
Bengali?
Vedanta commentary?
No. No. Their books are all books of linguistic theory. They don't go to the Vedanta Sutra. But the same author may also write a Vedanta Sutra commentary. There are certain scholars who write books in several different schools, like Vajaspati Mishra. You'll find him writing Vedanta commentary and also a book on Spotavad. But in Spotavad itself, they don't deal with Vedanta sutras. They don't deal with scripture. It's like the Nyaya school or the grammarians. They just deal with their business. with linguistic matters.
Is Bhartrihari the same as that Bhartrihari who wrote the Vairagya Shatakam and...
I'm sorry?
Is this the same Bhartrihari who wrote Vairagya Shatakam and Niti Shatakam and all?
Yeah, same Bhartrihari.
Same Bhartrihari.
What did he write?
The Vairagya Shatakam, Shringara Shatakam.
Yeah, he wrote those. Those are Mayavadi books. So he also wrote regular Mayavadi books.
I heard
he's also a Vedantist.
I heard he, in the later past of his life, he was attracted to Shaiva Siddhanta and he went to South and he became a Shaiva Sannyasi like that.
Maybe. Maybe, or maybe it's just a story. Okay, we'll stop for now. We'll continue tomorrow with the Spotavad, but it's not as impossible to understand as this Prabhakara stuff was. Okay? Thank you, all glories to Srila Prabhupada, Srimad Bhagavatam.